This podcast is sponsored by Low No Drinker magazine, the number one UK magazine for the sober, curious drinker, bringing you news, reviews and interviews from the people, places and brands leading the low and no alcohol revolution. As a Sober Rebel listener, use code SOBERREBEL15 to get 15% off any digital or print subscription from the Low No Drinker magazine for 6 whole months. Hello and welcome to the Sober Rebel podcast, the show where I talk to people about the benefits of sobriety and all that it's brought to them, because going sober isn't easy, but it does make life a lot easier. And so today I have got the pleasure of talking to Annie. Annie has a really interesting job with the NHS, but she's also incorporated her sobriety and her passion for it in her work. So let's find out more. Annie, hello, how are you? It's lovely to see you and welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for coming on it. I've been waiting a long time to talk to you.
Oh, Louisa, I'm so happy to be here. It's been a while since we actually last met in person.
And
I'm really excited to be here talking to you today.
So tell the listeners a little bit about your sobriety. How long have you been sober now?
So my sober date was the 28th of December 2021. So that must make me 2 years and 2 months nearly.
Congratulations. That is amazing. How does it feel? 2 years, 2 months.
Do you know, it just feels like a new life. I mean, it is my new normal. You know, sometimes I don't have to concentrate on not being not drinking anymore. You know, I concentrate on life, and that's really my new normal. Although saying that, I'm sure we'll talk about it in this podcast, but a lot of my work that I do is centered around alcohol these days. So it's not as if I'm completely ignoring alcohol. It's just that, you know, now my life is just so much better without it that I really don't need to focus on it and stress about it like I used to. So, you know, 2 and a bit years later, just life is so much calmer and just, yeah, so wonderful.
It's great, isn't it? So what was your relationship with alcohol like then? What made you think that you wanted to go sober?
So I was a pretty boring teenager, to be honest with you. I, you know, did everything age appropriate. I was still going out to the roller disco at age 15 when my friends were probably out in the local park swigging the overproof cider because I didn't like alcohol. I didn't like the taste of it. And I really didn't really try it properly, I don't think, till I was about 18. And even then, it was a case of just, you know, drinking something ridiculously sweet just so I could get it down my throat. I mean, my drink, the first drink I ever had was a Malibu and pineapple. It was disgusting.
Oh, I can't think of anything worse.
No, I know. And I remember even when I went to university, I was the sort of person who was extremely social and I loved to sort of hang out in pubs with friends. But I remember being able to sit there with a half a pint of lager shandy, and that would last me an entire night because I just didn't want to drink it. I didn't really see alcohol as something big in my life when I was younger. I definitely picked up drinking a little bit more and more frequently in my 20s, just hanging out with friends and keeping them company drinking, really. But I do remember at the time, you know, in my 20s, it was a case of only ever drinking socially, never drinking alone at home. You know, I was a big conformist drinker, as David Nutt would say, in a way, you know, just to keep everybody else company, to fit in. And I didn't see my drinking as any, you know, it wasn't problematic at all in my 20s. I think it started to ramp up a little bit in my 30s, where, you know, I was a young mum. I had to stay at home a lot with my daughter at the time, because I will come on to it later, there was a few issues with me and my husband and his drinking, which kind of left me at home alone, needing company. And that's where I discovered wine was the easiest thing to have in the fridge. And even still then, I do remember that actually, you know, I would keep a bottle of wine in the fridge, knowing that my husband was going to be coming home, to try and share that bottle with him. So we did drink at home, but I would probably only have about a glass and a half before he came home every night, because I'd always want to reserve a little bit because I saw that the alcohol was more or less the glue between us. That then sort of was my normal. You know, it was okay to drink at home, and it was okay to drink with my husband because he was drinking a lot, and it kind of made me feel like I was in a team with him, if you like. It gave us a little bit more of a connection in the evenings when he came home from work and from the pub himself. But for me, you know, the drinking was always a little excessive, definitely out with friends. I still didn't see it as abnormal. All my friends drank the same as me. So it wasn't a case of, you know, me being out of the loop. I wasn't anything different. You know, all my friends drank the same as me. And you do keep that company, don't you? You know, you choose your friends because they're like you. We had a bit of a drink culture, definitely. I work for the NHS. You know, you work hard, you play hard. It was quite normal, especially when I first started working at the trust where I work currently back in the mid-90s. At the time, I was working with a group of people who they were mostly all either single, or if they were married, they didn't have children. And so literally we would finish work and go straight to the pub every night. And that became the culture. And you find your work tribe, you know, you want to be like everybody else. So you sort of hang out with everybody in the pubs. And that became just the norm for me at the time. I seem to remember most of my wages in the late 90s would just go straight into the bar till. You know, I didn't really have any savings at all because that became completely normal for me and my colleagues, you know. That's where we had all of our socials, where we sort of met after work to, you know, put the day to rights and work out, you know, how we'd all done and everything. It's just the way that everybody kind of worked at the time. And again, I saw that as normal. It wasn't anything abnormal because the people that I was hanging out with were all doing exactly the same. I think work has been stressful throughout the last, I mean, I've worked for the NHS now for 32 years. I'm a sonographer by, that's what I do for my living at the moment, but I've been through a number of different sort of roles. So I've been your clinical sonographer that would have done your scans. I've been a site lead. I've been a manager of five hospitals, and I'm currently now an education and training lead sonographer for my trust, teaching people how to do ultrasound. But there was a time definitely in the sort of early, what do you call the decade between 2010 and 2020? I never know
Oh, I
what
don't know, the 2010s.
the teens. Yeah, so in the early teens, you know, I was asked to be in a leadership position because somebody went on maternity leave, and that was the manager position over five hospitals. And it was a very stressful job. You know, you're kind of thrown into a job and you're a full-time mum. You've got a husband who's drinking. You know, there's all these stresses. And actually, what I found is that my drinking definitely changed around that time to solution drinking for stress relief. But again, I think at the time, even then, I would say that I actually had a couple of days off in the week because, you know, I wanted to prove to myself that I didn't have a problem. But I think subconsciously, I did realize that I was drinking too much because it didn't make me feel great. But I wanted to at least prove to myself that, you know, I didn't drink 7 days a week. So the stress relief drinking started definitely around that time. Prior to that, I would say, you know, when my children were growing up in the noughties, it was loneliness drinking. So loneliness had suddenly become stress drinking. And then that carried on really for the whole of the teens. And then COVID hit. And so I didn't really think that I had a problem before COVID because, as far as I could see, I was drinking the same as everybody else. You know, and then COVID hit and we were all thrown into new positions. We were suddenly put under a lot more stress at work because of changing policies. There was, you know, the PPE issues at the very beginning of the first lockdown. Suddenly, you know, everybody on high alert, people running at speed within the walls of the hospital. and actually still trying to remain calm outside. And it was impossible, really, because when you're dealing in a high stress situation like that, where we'd never really been given any training for that kind of pandemic situation, we were literally thrown in. If I'm honest, I was almost on adrenaline running through that first lockdown. I remember the first, I'd say the first 3 months, I don't think I had a break. I think I worked every single weekend. So it was like, nonstop, 7 days a week, 24/7 for the first, say, 3 months. And there was a lot of retraining to be done internally as well with staff that were suddenly being given new duties that we'd never done before. I was personally dealing with staff who were coming to me, telling me that they were worried going home to vulnerable relatives, worried that they were going to potentially take the disease home and infect their families. I had people coming telling me that they'd only just found out they were pregnant. What were they meant to do? But at the time, the government was telling us NHS staff have to come to work. You have to come. And they also said at the very beginning that pregnancy was fine. There was no issues with pregnancy, which is why our antenatal department still carried on, and as a sonographer, we were still scanning our antenatal patients. All of the rules kept changing, and we were dealing with that internally. And what I found is that, yes, I was acting like an absolute, star at work, and I was there for everybody else, and I'm listening to everybody else's worries. But then you go home and you need to decompress yourself. What I didn't say earlier is that my husband actually, did have a drinking problem, went to AA himself twice. First time it lasted for a couple of years. Second time was 2016, and he's not drank since. And
Wow.
I'd come home every night to two children who don't drink and my husband who doesn't drink. And then I'm obviously, it's like a mirror is being held up to me in that period of time, because I suddenly realized that where I'd always tried to have a couple of days off, that wasn't happening anymore. And what I realized was I had this cyclical drink, sleep, work, stress, repeat, rinse, repeat constantly for, I'd say, from March straight through till August. There was not a day off. And that for me led to my stress levels just being, unmanageable. I really felt like I'd hit a wall at the end of July. And I remember looking in the mirror and just, I was the biggest I'd ever been. I was bloated. I had terrible skin. I just looked awful. I could see I physically didn't look well. And so at that point, I didn't think that it was all related to alcohol. To me, I was still putting the way that I was feeling on the stress of the pandemic. Yet there was a moment for me where I was in Sainsbury's straight after I'd finished work one night. And I remember being down the wine aisle, the booze aisle, and I'm standing there looking at this bottle of wine and thinking, I don't want this. I really don't want it. But I just couldn't help myself. I went and just picked the bottle up and I put it in the basket. And I remember thinking at the time, you know what? I've really got to stop this. I've got a problem. And it was just that moment that I can still remember now where I thought, I feel worse than I've ever felt before. This is not going to make me feel any better, but I just knew I was powerless. And that was the moment I think I accepted that, I was powerless over alcohol and something needed to happen. It was literally that night I went home. I didn't want to discuss it with my husband because he hadn't really had a discussion with me about my drinking, because a lot of it I think I was doing, not in view of him. I was literally going into the utility room and pretending I had to do the washing or the ironing and spending a bit of time in there and having a bottle of something in the cupboard. He didn't really see what I was drinking. So I secretly Googled, am I an alcoholic? Finding Annie Grace online, and saw that she did an alcohol experiment, and I did the free version that you can do online. I did that completely by myself, and I decided at that moment, okay, I'm going to just prove to myself that I don't have a problem, and I am going to do a month of no alcohol. But at the same time, I know they say you shouldn't do this, but I did at the time. I thought, right, this is a full month of detox. I am going for a full healthy diet. I'm going to see if I can lose some weight. I'm going to really up my exercise and just really try and feel better. And I did it really successfully. I stuck to the plan. I did it completely by myself. I downloaded William Porter's Alcohol Explained and listened to Annie Grace's This Naked Mind, both at the same time on my dog walks, as well as doing the alcohol experiment. And I was able to do 45 days, completely by myself then. But then you get to the end of that and you think to yourself, okay, I'm good now. I've proven that I'm fine. I'd lost a little bit of weight. I was feeling better, definitely sleeping better, and just thought, right, I'm just good to go. And at the end of that time, that 45 days, it was actually my birthday month. I slowly crept up. Definitely, my birthday's at the end of October. And for the first half, I think I'd actually maybe had one or two drinks, managed to keep it sensible. And then by the second half of the month, closer to my birthday, it was just like, right, every night. Because the problem is, the whole of my adult life, I'd use my birthday as an excuse to extend the celebrations for, anything from a week to 2 weeks before and after the event. It's almost like my birthday was a really big thing to me. And it's interesting that the second lockdown in the UK came in the November. So literally, I'd got completely wasted over my birthday a couple of weeks, and then we were thrown straight back into lockdown. And I just thought, do you know what? I was craving the way that I was feeling that first time. And I just made a promise to myself that I was going to do the second lockdown completely alcohol free and see, how long I could extend it for. Unfortunately, a friend of mine, a work colleague, died early December. And so I'd done the whole month alcohol free, and then he died, and I took that really badly. He was very close. And it was Christmas. There's too many reasons not to drink. And so I went straight back into drinking for that December. And then the January came, and I just thought, right, you get a taste of what it feels like to be alcohol free, and you just want to keep, go back to that again. So in the January, I decided, I'm going to do this again. That was now the third time I'd tried to take a break. Since that moment, I tried to picked that bottle of wine up to put it in my basket. And I was lucky in that January, that was January of 21. I started to reach out to people, make virtual friends on these groups, and link in with one of the coaches on the group, a lady called Ellie Crowe. And I decided, you know what? I'm going to push myself. I know that I've done a month three times now, and I'm going to do this again. And so I decided to join her group. Still didn't tell my husband. I told him I was joining a health and well-being group, and I decided to go off and do this with her instead. And it was just the moment that so much opened up to me because, just being in a small group with another five women who were scattered all over the world as well, it suddenly made me realize that, there were people outside of the UK that actually are also wanting to give up alcohol. And that it's not just me, you're not alone. And these other women, oh my goodness, we shared so much in that group. We became pretty vulnerable with each other. We were able to really talk quite openly about alcohol in our life and what it had done for us, not done for us, how we'd used it. Yeah, I think in a way that was the start of me developing sober friendships. What I wanted to say as well is that when I was in the January alcohol experiment, I did actually meet up with a lady called Maria, who was somebody that I'm going to come back to later because we bonded over the fact that she works for the police, I work for the NHS. We'd both come to the pandemic with so much stress. And yeah, I think, meeting people through these groups and forming these friendships is just what completely drives you forward with wanting to carry on, that accountability that you have with them. So Ellie Crowe teaches us for the first time the most amazing things that I'd never even heard about before, like meditation, mindfulness, journaling, values and beliefs, listening
Yeah,
to
they're
your
massively
values.
important. Yeah.
Oh my God, I realized that I was actually spinning out of control. One of the reasons that I think that I was so stressed during the pandemic, but not just then. At the beginning of those teens, as we said earlier, not having a work-life balance or really putting most of my values on work rather than what really, really mattered to me, which for me, having done a values exercise now, understanding that actually my values are very much about my own health and well-being plus my family. Work doesn't really figure in there. Do you know what I mean? And it was,
Yeah.
I was pushing everything towards my work life and not spending enough time on myself or on my family. So developing those practices and really understanding a little bit more about myself through those kind of exercises that we did with our small group was just life-changing. It really was.
Values are unbelievably useful to understand because we all kind of intrinsically know we have them, but unless you're really aware, and they can change over time, your values as you have a family or as the family grow up and as your job changes, you'll find they do morph and change. But what I noticed when I did my values, and I often work through this with clients as well, is that alcohol impacts on pretty much every value that I had. And that's another way to show how alcohol is impinging on things that are really important to us and pretending it doesn't.
Yeah, you're right. You know, the values were totally clouded by the alcohol as well.
And look, I mean, you went through the pandemic in a way that people, you know, the majority of people didn't. I was pregnant at the time, so I was going into people like you and having scans and relying and trusting that it was safe. I was being told it was safe. I mean, it's a very intimate kind of thing, isn't it? When you're in a room with a sonographer, it's really quite close proximity. It was very intimidating. And I should imagine it must have been for you as well, really quite worrying.
It was, you know, because at the very beginning, when we didn't have any PPE, a sonographer has to scan a patient at arm's length. So you're in breathing space. So, you know, it's either you could catch it from us or we could catch it from the patient. Do you know what I mean? And so it was a very stressful time, the bit at the very beginning when there was no PPE in the country and only the intensive care staff could have it. I think there was a lot of just hugely highly stressful staff.
Thinking about the stress that everybody else, because we were all thinking of all the medical staff and the teams working, but actually thinking about the stress that you were going through, not stopping, not having a day off, and then you trying to unwind in that highly stressed situation.
Well, do you know what I realise now? And it was only from listening to a podcast a couple of weeks ago, actually. The term anhedonia, I totally get now that I had anhedonia and wasn't aware of it because all of those micro stresses, they build to the point that you hit a wall and you do feel sort of blah. You have absence of joy. Absence of happiness. You know, I realize now the alcohol was really contributing to that. It wasn't allowing me any space to recover. So, like you say, little things that you may not have noticed coming in as a patient were big things to us, you know? And it was like you have multiples of things going on during COVID where we felt a little bit out of control. You know, to the rest of the world, we're looking like, yeah, we're coping and everything. But at the same time, for me going into work, it was multiple micro stresses throughout the day. You know, that conversation with a member of staff that was scared to go home to a relative, the woman that was pregnant, you know, dealing with meetings, dealing with never-ending policies and whatever. And you would get home. And the only way to sort of have that relief was to have the glass of wine or the bottle, I should say, and just to put those thoughts to rest. And it was a false way of being able to relieve the stress that I was under at the time. And I'm sure, you know, there'll be multiple other NHS staff who probably were feeling exactly the same way because we didn't have that outlet to be able to say, look, you know, we need a break. I need to tell somebody I'm not coping because you just had to cope. You had to run. You had to go with it, you know.
Yeah, I can't imagine what that must have been like actually working within the NHS at that time. I've got
You know
so
what
much
was really
respect.
lovely was all of the wonderful gifts, you know, that people sent to the NHS and the lovely praise that you know we heard. The people standing outside or hanging from the windows, clapping, the rainbows in the windows. I mean, you have no idea how much that made me feel really emotional. Every Thursday when people went out and did that, it was needed, definitely in those early days. But yeah, the rainbows. They've been a very big sort of consideration of mine in my whole alcohol journey. And the thing is, at the time, we were looking at the rainbows, I think, as society, as something beautiful, because we were going to get to the end of the rainbow and there was going to be a pot of gold, and one day COVID would finish and we'd all be back to normal. And I think we were hoping that, the pot of gold would come quickly. The thing is, the rainbow for me signifies so much more, because my Instagram name is Alcohol Free Rainbow Rider. And the reason for that is, the moment I stood on the doorstep and heard the applause and clapped for everybody else as well, I was clapping for everybody and feeling emotional and thinking, when will all of this end? When can I start to feel normal again? It's carried over into the whole alcohol-free journey as well. You think that the pot of gold is the prize, but actually the rainbow is the pot of gold. And it's about traveling the rainbow and enjoying the rainbow and enjoying everything that's on that journey. And I feel, for me and my alcohol-free journey, I'm still on the rainbow. I'm still riding it. It means it's so much to me that the rainbows signify my journey from that COVID first end of the pandemic, first lockdown, putting that bottle of wine in my basket and taking it home and making that decision that, something needs to change here. And so I've been riding this rainbow. And, one of the things that I really want to do is to help a lot of other people who are in my position to be able to sort of rediscover life without alcohol, because there is so much more on the other end. It's about appreciating just how beautiful this journey is.
Yeah, which leads us so nicely then onto, because I asked my guests to come on here and talk about three areas of their life or three things that they have noticed in sobriety that they would never have been doing or feeling as a drinker. So what's your first one?
So my first one is awakening my senses, because, like I said to you before, remember, I'd done that first period of not drinking, and then I hit my birthday, and I used to have this thing where I always needed everybody else to celebrate with me. I could never celebrate my birthday by myself. I had to involve as many people as possible. And in 2021, I call that my moderation year, because even though I said to you that I started the year and did 100 days, I managed 138 days at the beginning of 2021, but then I kind of went back to moderating over the summer. But I really kept trying that year. I kept thinking to myself, I really want to keep going with this. And so I wanted to make that my year of firsts. And even if I had already had a drink at some point, or I'd had a little slip up, I decided I wanted to do a first holiday, a first gig, a first, I tried a lot of firsts. And this was the year that I had my first sober birthday. And I remember at the time that I had probably only been sober about 2 weeks, but I'd made this decision. I am going to have the first ever sober birthday I've had where I've not been pregnant and be able to enjoy my birthday without alcohol. And I thought to myself, well, how am I going to do that, with all of my friends who like to drink? This is going to be quite difficult. So what I decided to do is take myself off to this spa that somebody had recommended to me. And it was just outside of London, and it wasn't a spa that comes with a bar and a hotel. It was literally almost like a rejuvenation kind of type spa. They did really nice vegan food there. There was no alcohol, there's no bar, there was no coffee, there was no caffeine. It was a bit of a place to go and really just experience healthiness. They had all of the wonderful treatments and everything there, but they also did these classes where they did mindfulness, they did aromatherapy, they did, things that really kind of help with awakening the senses, if you like. And I went by myself. And this for me was really unusual, because I'd always wanted to celebrate my birthday with other people. So to be able to go away and spend 3 nights in a place where I actually did end up making friends with a number of other people that were there by themselves as well, which was lovely. But just to have the massages, the facials, to really relax and to go to the meditation mindfulness classes, to really, listen and pay attention to the aromatherapy class. We went out on a lovely nature walk and to experience the sunrise for the first time. I don't think I'd ever really got up and watched, the sun coming up before that birthday. And I just had the most amazing first few days of that birthday. And I track my sleep with my Fitbit. My sleep scores were amazing. And I just thought to myself, oh my God, I'd exercise there as well because they had a gym. So basically, every single sense was awakened during that time, which I had gifted to myself for my birthday and had gone and done something completely out of the ordinary for me. And it was just a moment of, I didn't need, so an awakening of, I don't need other people, to have this fantastic sleep and to have this energy and to feel as well as I did. It was all dependent on just me going with my senses to this wonderful place that allowed me to feel them, if you like, and experience them. So that was definitely one of the first times that I realized, oh my God, I can actually be by myself and feel great, and to experience the senses in that way. But then subsequently, I've been very lucky that I've managed to, in the last 2 years that I've been sober, I've kind of been tracking the amount of alcohol and the money that I've saved on an app. And even though I've not really been physically putting it into a bottle or into a bank, I can see that I've saved that amount of money and I've decided to spend it on two trips to Bali.
Oh,
So
wow.
I went to Bali in 22 and Bali in 23 as well. And again, going to a place like that where going to Ubud, going to a retreat where you wake up in the morning, hear the natural sounds of the frogs croaking, the cock-a-doodle-doos, you've got the cicadas. It was amazing. And then to see the sun rising, starting my day with yoga, beautiful yoga practice, and then gorgeous breakfast, provided by the chef there. And then we'd always do activities on these holidays, which had already been pre-arranged for us, but they were really wholesome activities. So we would do things like cooking together, Balinese cooking class, or we would go and make mala beads together where we could be talking and, drinking lovely tea and things. There was fantastic walks in nature, swimming under waterfalls, standing whilst the water just, oh, it was just amazing. I mean, just to experience my senses in a place like that, it was like one step further than that spa. Do you know what I mean? It was like, what to do next? And I think in a way, I've been chasing my sensory experiences ever since that time I had my birthday because I just thought I want to feel this good again. And so I love seeing sunrises. I love seeing sunsets. I love being by the beach and just watching the waves, as they come in and out. I just love the rhythmical ebb and flow of the sea. It's like things that I never would have found pleasure in previously, suddenly become just the most amazing experiences that really, really fill me up. I'd never experienced anything like that. I was just running with life, and I wasn't paying any attention to my senses. So, now I feel like I taste the food. I really appreciate my food. I listen to the birds. I can go for a walk, even if I know I've got a busy day at work. My mindfulness carries on now. I can walk between my house and the tube station, and I will have experienced so much in that short walk because I've almost been trained to do it because of the experiences that I've been very fortunate to have. It's just having that mindfulness in your everyday moments throughout a normal working day. But yeah, experiencing the awakening of my senses has just been the most magical thing.
Well, you've sold that. Absolutely, 100%. My word. I mean, mindfulness is one of those terms, again, that's bandied around. And if you go in and see a doctor about anxiety or what have you, they will say, have you thought about mindfulness techniques? And it's so powerful, but I've never heard anyone describe it as powerfully as you've just described it. That is amazing. All five senses, tasting the food, experiencing things, listening to things. And that's what life's about. And that hedonic point that you talked about as well, the anhedonia. And then when it sort of comes back in, it's magical.
Oh my goodness. My eyes are open all the time. Smells as well. I mean, who smells anything? It's like, you can appreciate just everything once you become aware of it. And I think, when we're drinking, we're just not aware of anything.
And I mean, I like when I go to bed, I'll put, I love a L'Occitane cream, like hand cream and things, and I'll always smell the cream. And I never did that as a drinker. I
No.
wasn't bothered. I probably had cracked hands. I mean, I just, but there's something about putting the bed linen on and you get into bed and the smell. And yeah, absolutely. All five senses, and they are awakened.
Do you know what? There's nothing nicer than just beautiful sheets, especially when especially if you've had a hard day at work or whatever, just getting into bed and lovely smelling, fresh sheets and a good book, low lighting, just that whole feeling of feeling co comfortable and cozy. Can't wait to go to bed actually these days.
I know, I'm a bit like that. My husband falls asleep on the sofa at 8. But yeah, it is, isn't it? It's about that relaxation. It's about, there is so much more to life. And I think back to almost an unconscious stumbling to bed. I would do. I was never drunk, but I wasn't aware. I probably wouldn't take my makeup off. I probably couldn't give a damn what the sheets were doing, And it's something else, actually, to then be so present in everything. So you've definitely sold that one. I fancy a trip to Bali, but I'd like to do it and leave the girls here with Dale.
Oh, you can't go with your children or your husband. You've got to go. I went on a women's trip. It was amazing.
Brilliant.
Yeah, you go alone. You don't go with
That's not the
anybody.
point. That's not
No,
relaxing.
no.
So what is your second?
So my second one is connecting with my inner child.
Ooh, go on.
So, first of all, I had a very happy childhood in a beautiful family. However, I am adopted and I am the only adopted child in a family of seven children. So they are all natural, blonde, blue-eyed, tall. I'm short, dark, and very different looking to my family. So my mother had my brother first and had a difficult delivery with him in the late 60s. And the doctors at the time told her, don't have any more children. It's going to be difficult for you. We suggest, you stop. And so she desperately wanted to have more children. So she thought, well, I'm going to adopt a number of children because she wanted to have a bigger family. And so I was meant to be the first of a number of children she was going to adopt. My brother at the time was only a year older than me, so can't remember life without me. And I was adopted at 8 months old. The rest all came along naturally. She kind of ignored the doctor's advice and just the local hospital kept a bed for her, I think. But the thing is, I've always been there as the big sister. Well, when all the others came along, but they are, I am not joking, Louisa, they are identical. They are absolute clones of each other. And so I've always felt and looked different. In my family, we all got on extremely well. They were a beautiful family, but we just never talked about my adoption. So I kind of grew up not really being able to discuss it with anybody, always knowing that, especially if we ever went anywhere as a family, I was the sort of person that I think I dimmed my light as a child because I didn't want to stand out. I didn't want people to suddenly point me out and say, oh, is she the milkman's or whatever, because I desperately wanted to fit in with my own family. And so I was not a confident child. I was quiet. I didn't really want to be pointed out. I didn't want people to see me. I didn't put my hand up in class. I think it affected me without me even noticing and really understanding it when I was younger, And it took me until I'd been about a year sober. After I'd done my first sober year, where all of a sudden things started to happen for me. And it's almost like the alcohol just allowed me to part the waves of my life and to start thinking, okay, let's look at what is going on here. In a group I was in, we were talking about trauma, and a lady that I was talking to had been through a lot of family trauma herself. And of course, I could see that there was a reason why she had been drinking, because she had big T trauma. And yet, when I was talking about my life, I actually said, but my life's a bit boring, nothing's really happened. And then I mentioned the adoption, and she said, do you realize that's not just small T trauma, that's big T trauma? And that was the first time that anybody had ever said to me that I actually had a reason for something that had made me the way I am as an adult. It almost, I had no idea that the abandonment that happens with adoption is so huge, and especially so if it's in that first 6 months. Because if you look at any of the sort of literature around this, a child needs to have somebody to bond with. A child needs to mirror a caregiver. They need to feel loved, protected, held, all of those things. And do you know something? I have a black hole in the first 8 months of my life. I don't know where I was. I don't know who had me, who looked after me, because my parents, my adoptive parents, don't know. They never talked about it. And so I'm almost now having to try and put the pieces of my life together. I did actually meet my birth mother myself. I searched for her after my own daughter was born. And I have to say, the moment my daughter was born, I don't think I've ever felt a feeling like it, because the minute I held her, I just knew she was the only flesh and blood that I had on this earth, because everybody knows their parents, everybody knows who their relatives are, their ancestors. It's like I had nothing. I had this adopted family, which were lovely, it always made me feel welcome. But the fact is, internally, I knew that my daughter was the only flesh and blood that I had. And so, that feeling of how can somebody give their baby away was so strong when I had her that I then went on to do my own searching for my birth mother. And when I found her, we did have a very successful reunion. So that would have been about 2008. And it was very nice to meet her. She was grateful that I'd found her. But at the same time, she did say at the time, I feel that what I did, giving you up, was kind of tantamount to murdering somebody. So that's how I felt. I was made to give you up, but I felt so guilty about it all of your life that I've never told a living soul. She said, so we've got to keep this between the two of us. So she basically said to me, I'm glad I found her, but she said, I'm never going to tell anybody about you. You don't exist. All of a sudden, I'm abandoned again. It was like another punch in the stomach that she doesn't want to acknowledge my existence. And in a way, as time's gone on, she's occasionally texted me, not really wanted to keep in touch. So again, that part of my life is, it's just a hole. There's an area in the first year of my life almost that I just can't account for. And it really explains why, I am so desperate to seek people's affection. I'm seeking approval. I'm a people pleaser. It all makes sense that, I've never had somebody to feel confident with that makes me feel confident, because that bond wasn't made there when I was a baby. And so I've chased it all of my life. I've chased it with other people, with other friends. It explains why I need that affirmation on my birthday, have all these people come and wish me happy birthday. It's like I cannot be happy with myself, or I felt like I couldn't for most of my adult life. My happiness depended on everybody else, not myself. And so understanding that there was a reason, and suddenly having this awareness of, oh my God, okay, I know there is a reason for my people pleasing. There's a reason that I ended up giving in to drink in a way for other people, you know,
Yeah.
that social drinking, even though I was the sort of person who started off who didn't like the taste of alcohol. I should
Yeah,
have just.
you were really pleasing people, weren't you? You
I
were
was
sort of
drinking
almost.
for everybody and to be with everybody and that conformist drinking to keep up with everybody. I mean, I typify the person who will put their hand in the fire for anybody else because, you know, that's the way I was made. These are my life experiences. The fact that I never had that bond in the first year of my life. I mean, that explains it for me that I've been chasing that bonding with somebody for the whole of my life. But the thing of the connecting with my inner child was through being sober and suddenly realizing, okay, well, what can I do now with all of this? You know, I've got this awareness that yes, that and it was reading the book What Happened to You by Oprah Winfrey and Bruce D. Perry that did it for me. It was an amazing book where she explains in one of her chapters about that first 6 months and the need for a baby to have that bond with a caregiver. It made so much sense to me. Yeah, I just realized that I needed to do something with this information. You know, how do I process it all? How do I recover from it all? And actually, again, there's so many sobriety groups and resources that are out there. I'm just like, I'm in awe of just how much is around at the moment that people can tap into. And I don't know if you know Josh Connolly. I did his Inner You course, which is a breathwork course. I actually really love breathwork, and that's really helped me as well with stress relief. He touches a lot on that course with the inner child, where you literally, you know, can do a little bit of journaling around your inner child work, and then you can do the breath work to release that tension. And so that was one of the ways that I dealt with it. And then one of the other ways was when I was in Bali doing my yoga practice. You know, I used to think that yoga was just a bit of a stretching and, you know, a form of exercise, but actually, yoga is so important in terms of releasing emotional burdens, stress, tension, everything, you know, because
Yeah.
you concentrate on your breath, because you concentrate on just holding poses and developing your strength. I remember when I was in Bali, had this wonderful yoga teacher who was talking us through the whole sort of inner child thing as we were doing the yoga piece. We were actually holding positions. The sun was shining on me. It was the morning. And she ended the session as we were sitting quietly after we'd sort of released our hips and everything. They say that you carry a lot of tension in your hips. We'd done a lot of hip work that morning. And I remember sitting there quietly, and then she just sang this song, which I think was probably a song in the 70s called Ooh Child. I don't know if you know it. It's a beautiful, beautiful song. And she sang it just a cappello by herself. And the words of it were, "Ooh, child, things are going to get easier. Ooh, child, things are going to get brighter. You're going to walk in the sunshine." I can't remember the exact words, but it was almost like that moment, doing that, having done that yoga practice, really concentrated on my breath, being in one of the most beautiful places ever, awakening my senses, and then sitting there, having gone through the understanding of why I was the way I was. And I just remember sitting there and just bawling my eyes out and thinking, I've brought my inner child back home to a place in the sunshine where we can start again. We can start from the beginning. We don't have to worry about everything that's happened to us. We're going to start right here. We're going to grow together. I understand you. I'm going to be here with you. I am going to make sure that you are going to have, you know, the care and attention that and the bond with me, you know, your outer
Yeah.
self. And that moment was really just the start of my healing, I think, you know, being in Bali, realizing that I had released a little bit with the breath work course, but in Bali, in the sunshine, after the yoga, and just thinking, right, okay, what do I need to do next? And the next thing was to go to adoption therapy. And I had the therapy, And I really let a lot go because I think I was, a little bit angry towards my birth mother and the fact she didn't want to acknowledge me. But at the end of the day, one of the things that I've really learned throughout the whole of the sobriety journey is that everybody was doing the best that they could with the tools that they had at the time. The 60s were a very different time to now. There's no way that, very few babies get given away in this day and age unless, they're taken away by social services. Nobody wants to give the babies away because society is happy to accept that, mothers don't need to be married or, it's a very different society today. It really is. And I think just going through therapy and talking it through with somebody made me realize that I can't change the way that she thinks. I have no control over anybody else's thoughts, actions. I can only control my own. So to be honest, that metaphorical backpack that we all carry throughout our lives, where we put these worries and stresses into them and we keep on carrying them and it gets heavier and heavier and heavier, it was time for me to unload the backpack. And I did that with therapy. I took out the whole, birth mother piece, laid it all to rest, and just thought, right, okay, so now I'm just going to make my inner child as happy as possible, doing all the wonderful things that my inner child wanted to do, which were things like, as a child, as a teenager, I stopped dancing because my parents had too many children and weren't able to sort of come and take us to shows or make the clothes for the shows. Or I had all these, I loved acting, I loved dancing. And what I've done in my sobriety is I joined an amateur dramatic society because I thought, okay, well, I'm going to give this to my inner child. I'm going to make sure that you get what you didn't get while you were growing up, And the same with my dancing. I don't know if you saw, I was at the House of Happiness last week.
I saw the trousers. They were
Oh my God,
cool.
I'll tell you what, I just dance now. When I hear the music, I just get that. I get up there and I dance. And I don't care who's watching because I'm dancing. I love dancing. I love music. And yeah, I think, just because I stopped because there wasn't that support for me when I was younger, it doesn't mean that I can't do it now. And so I'm kind of just living my life again, me and my inner child. We're doing all the things that we couldn't do because of other people or because we didn't feel confident enough, I suppose, in a number of ways as well, Yeah, just so much has happened. So yeah, lots of inner child awakening, healing, which has been great.
And so, what's your third thing?
So the third thing is the power of sharing and networking alcohol-free. So first of all, I would say that I met this lady called Maria from the police force, and we kind of bonded over stress in our jobs. And we stayed friends over the next couple of years. And she put on last year in January of 23 a pilot alcohol experiment just for the police force. And I mentored on that. And so, at that point, I'd just turned a year alcohol free. And it was really good for me to have that additional January month to extend, my own. So, because when like for a lot of people, you reach a year and you think, well, what do I do now? And so
Yeah, what
I used
next?
my, yeah, exactly. So I used my skills and my knowledge at the time with being alcohol free and my enthusiasm to mentor a number of police officers through a Dry January project. And it was great. And we had a really good time. And I think at that point, there was probably about 250 police officers on there. I also had bumped into our drug and alcohol team were holding some sort of awareness day in the hospital foyer when I was at work one day. There was a stall there where they were handing out leaflets for alcohol awareness. And of course, I was just curious because I'd just done a year and I walked over to them and I was like, oh, what's all this about? And this chap was the head nurse for the drug and alcohol team. And when I told him that I had, managed to quit alcohol and not done it through an AA route and hadn't really needed the support of, those kind of organizations, He was quite amazed because I don't think he'd ever met anybody like me, because I was literally like jumping on, like I was on a trampoline, saying, I'm so excited to talk to you because I would love to tell you about everything that I've done and all that I've experienced. And anyway, we swapped numbers and he got involved and said to me, would I like to train as an alcohol champion for my hospital trust in the NHS? So it meant that I had to go off and do some online training. It was alcohol identification and brief advice, being able to give brief advice to patients. And I suppose in my job as a sonographer, we scan people for fatty livers. So, these people are already at risk of potentially developing cirrhosis in the future. And the idea was that I should be able to, have a brief conversation with the patient when they come in to be able to sort of guide them towards a healthier lifestyle options and whatever. And it was really interesting when I did this training because I realized that not everybody in the NHS gets it. Okay. If I hadn't have bumped into this chap in the corridor to have had this conversation and been so excited to tell him that I was alcohol free and that, I'm happy to help in whatever way I can, he wouldn't have led me to this training. That then spiraled me to want to also become a health and wellbeing champion within my own trust. So I have now joined as a well-being champion for the NHS, and I attend meetings where they've been quite interested in the fact that, this whole grey area drinking spectrum, if you like, is something new, even to the NHS. I brought in William Porter to come and talk to our hospital staff. He came and did a CPD talk. I brought Janie Lee Grace in to do an online talk to talk about sober curiosity. And then worked with Maria, my friend again from the police, where we decided, like, let's make this bigger. We did the pilot with just the police in January of 23. Let's increase the size of this. So we then decided to bring in the NHS, the ambulance service, fire service, as well as the police force. We probably could have advertised it better. I think, what I would really like is, on the basis of the one that we've just done, if NHS organisations could get in touch and we could potentially advertise it in much, much wider next time for next year. We had over 700 participants on the group.
Wow.
It was amazing. It was amazing. So, a month-long alcohol experiment that we did for January of 24, we had 750 something participants. We brought in William Porter. He came back and was did a number of sessions for us. Yeah, so we were able to basically take the content from the live alcohol experiment that Annie Grace does, and then we put lives on every single night for January, where I as well had to go live, and I'm really not the most confident person on camera. It was like my confidence levels shot up throughout the whole month. It's been an amazing month of growth for me. It really has. But yeah, it was amazing because, people came to this not quite knowing what on earth they were putting themselves into. A lot of people said in the first week they'd never done more than a week sober. We've got a whole load of people who are now doing a dry February on the group. We've carried it on because when it came to the end, so many people had done the month so successfully. They said, can we carry on? So, yeah, the power of networking, once you give up alcohol and put yourself out there, when you decide to say yes to things. You go to events. You think, I'm going to come out of my comfort zone and just go.
It's
I can't
amazing.
begin to tell you just how much my life has. It's so colourful with all the people that are in it now, all the wonderful sober people that I've met. My life is a rainbow. It really is. It's a rainbow full of wonderful, beautiful people.
It's like I would love to be able to get a big billboard or something in central London and just go, look, sobriety is the biggest life hack you will ever come across.
We are the lucky ones. We
We are
really are.
the lucky ones.
We are.
Oh, thank you so much for joining me, Annie.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. It's been absolutely lovely chatting to you.
So if you'd like to find out more about Annie, you can follow her on Instagram and I will put the link in the show notes. And as always, if you want to find out more about myself, you can follow me on Instagram at Stepping Into Sobriety, or you can head to my website, louisaevans.com. where you'll find lots of useful links, including a link to my audiobook, Becoming a Sober Rebel. So thank you so much for joining us today, and I'll catch you next time.